Genesis chapter 26 tonight, and we'll just read a couple of verses from Genesis 26 and beginning of verse 1. And there was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, Go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. So we find that in this passage, there is some similarity as we consider the fact of Isaac and the famine that has occurred in Canaan, and how that he goes to the land of the Philistines and he goes to Abimelech. And so we'll see some comparisons here, and we'll look at some of these tonight just from these two verses of the life of Abraham in contrast to the life of Isaac. How that there is a parallel and there's much relation here. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that in this chapter in verse 1, it even connects us to Abraham and the famine that he had experienced back in chapter 12. And so it makes a distinction between the two, but by doing so, it draws also a connection to chapter 12 with the famine that Abraham experienced. So the chapter concerns the land and the situations during the lifetime now of Isaac. Remember, Abraham has died. He's moved on off the scene. And we find in these passages that they are very similar. The situations of life and the circumstances of life are very similar in the life of Isaac as they were in that of Abraham. And the life of Isaac in many ways parallels that of the life of Abraham in many ways. We see that in the text. Many of the same troubles within the life of Abraham are also experienced by Isaac. Just to name a few here, both had barren wives. We've already seen that truth. Sarah was barren. Rebecca was barren. Both had to deal with famines, as we see tonight in the text. Both lied concerning their wives for the sake of self-preservation. We saw that with Abraham in Egypt. And where else did we see that with Abraham? Do you remember? When did Abraham, he lied twice concerning the Sarah being his wife. Once was in the land of Egypt with Pharaoh. Who was the other one with? In which time? He's in the text as well tonight. It's Abimelech. He lied to Abimelech just like Isaac does. And so we find that, and whether this is Abimelech, the same Abimelech, or a descendant that is still Abimelech, regardless, it's the same king. It's the same kingdom, the kingdom of the Philistines. And we see that he lied just as Abraham had lied concerning his wife. So Isaac lies as well. And here's what's really interesting about it. In spite of all that, in spite of the fact they both had barren wives, they both dealt with famines, they both lied for the sake of self-preservation, they both yet still received the promise and blessing of God. And so, in many ways, the life of Abraham and Isaac truly do parallel. There's many similarities. The simple truth is that we may face problems of life and experience failures in life, but here's what's important for us to remember. The same Lord who reigned in the lives and in over the earth and in the lives of our fathers and in the lives of their fathers is the same God who reigns in our lives as well. And reigns over the affairs of life in our time and in our circumstances. There isn't as much difference as we may think exists between the problems of yesterday and today. You know, we have a tendency to do this. We have a tendency to look at the situations of life today and think, well, you know, our generations before never had to deal with these problems. Well, maybe not the specific problem that you deal with and I deal with, but they still had the same sin nature, and it was the same prince of the power of the air, Satan, who was still tempting men then as he tempts men today. Maybe different methods, maybe different means. But let me say this to you tonight. For instance, because this a lot of times catches a lot of flack, and it is true that this is so. Technology, for instance. Technology can be used for good, and technology can be used for evil. But let me just say this to you tonight, lest we be confused about the situation. Technology does not make man any more evil than he's ever been. It simply is a magnifying glass by which the wickedness of man is more so magnified. But it's not that it makes anyone even more wicked than they've ever been. And so, just as there were problems today, there were problems yesterday. And just as there are temptations today, there were temptations yesterday. And just as we face situations that we think are unique to us, in truth, though it may be unique in terms of, let's say, technology, for instance, one small area, it's no different than the problems that existed for our fathers and for their fathers. Just a different method. Just a different means by which it comes to us, maybe. And so the situations have not, for instance, okay, we can look even at drugs and things such as that and say, oh, look how bad it is today. Yes, it is proliferated today without a doubt. But don't be mistaken, there was drunkenness in the Scriptures, in the Old Testament. And people acted foolishly in the Old Testament, just like people act foolishly today. And so I think it's wrong for us to take the perception that today is just so much different than it's ever been before. Yes, different means, different methods. But remember, John says it like this. He tells us that we are not love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. And he who loveth the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And he says that all those things of the world perish. And what does he say? He says that it consists of these things, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And the truth of the matter is every temptation that man ever experiences falls under one of those three categories. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So though there may be different vehicles by which these temptations come to us today, none of these are new. Because in days gone by, men still had to contend with the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, just as we do today. So we don't need to be deceived into believing that things are just so much different today. Different vehicle, different means, different methods, but the same problem. By the way, if we really want to narrow it down, what's the real problem? We could say one or two things. Or what's the real problem? Sin. What's another thing we could say? What's the real problem? The flesh. The flesh. So either one of those would be correct. It's the flesh, because the flesh is sinful, it's sin. That is the problem. And so that's not changed. And we need to be aware of that. So my point is this. We're in a different generation now. Isaac is the son of Abraham. And by the way, Jacob's already born, right? Or well, we find that the Scripture gives reference to in this previous chapter concerning Jacob and Esau. So Jacob has been born, Esau has been born, and yet we find that there's two generations following that of Abraham now, and they experience the same problems Abraham experienced. But here's what we need to glean from this tonight, specifically. Though we face the same problems, maybe a different mean or different means or different methods, different vehicles or avenues by which it comes to us, we face the same situation, we contend with the same problems, we have the same sinful flesh. That's the issue at hand. Might I say to you, there's great comfort in knowing this also. The same God of Abraham was the God of Isaac, was the God of Jacob, and is our God tonight. So regardless of the situations and the circumstances, same problems, but hey, the same answer, the same God. And so there's nothing that is new to us, in truth, that has not already been experienced in terms of the sinfulness and simple nature of man. As Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, there is truly nothing new under the sun. There is nothing new under the sun. The same root problem exists, and Christ is still the answer to the sinfulness and simple nature of man. Look at verses 1 and 2 again with me. And there was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar, and the Lord appeared unto him and said, go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. Now the Scriptures not only mention this famine, but as we mentioned a moment ago, it draws a connection to Genesis 12. In Genesis 12 we find the famine that Abraham experienced. What did Abraham do as soon as the famine came? It was very grievous in the land. What did Abraham do? He went to Egypt. He went to Egypt. Now, we find that this is not the only famine in relation to Abraham. There was in Genesis 12, we find the famine that deals of Abraham during the days of Abraham. In Genesis 26, we find the famine in the days of Isaac. And in Genesis 46, we find there was a famine in the days of Jacob also. So, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, all three, were confronted with this issue of a famine. Now, why is this significant? Here's the question I want to ask you. Why is a famine significant in all three of their lifetimes? What significance does a famine have in relation to their lives? The answer is found in this. What had God promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as we'll see in a moment? What did God promise them? What else? Offspring, but offspring that would do what? Make a great nation. Where would they do that? Not in Egypt. Where were they going to make a great nation? What had God promised Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? What did He promise them? Canaan! He promised them the promised land, the promised land. Remember? That was a land that God had promised them. And so that is how this famine is significant, because the famine is where? In the promised land. Concerning Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there's a famine in the promised land. And hopefully you're going to see where this all connects now. So this is an issue. They are having to contend with a problem that deals with the flesh in the land that God had promised them, that their descendants would inherit, that they would possess. So we find that all three of them experience a famine in their lifetime. Now, there is something interesting about the famines and unique about each one concerning the three men that experienced these, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Let's look first at the famine in Abraham's day in Genesis 12:10. It says, "And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land." Now, what do we find? Let's observe what we read here in relation to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. First of all, God did not command Abraham to go to Egypt, did He? God never commanded him to do so. But we also must take notice that neither did He forbid Abraham to go to Egypt, did He? Did God say, "Don't go to Egypt, Abraham"? No. Did God say, "Go to Egypt, Abraham"? No. So what we must understand is God allowed Abraham to go to Egypt. Now, God did not instruct him to go, and God did not forbid him to go, but God did allow him to go. Listen, very, 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 very important. We must understand everything that God may allow us to do is not necessarily His will for us to do. Sometimes we think, well, I feel peace. Have you ever heard someone say that? "I've got peace about this." And I don't want to downplay it in saying that God does not give us peace, because He does. But hear me. Sometimes we have peace because we want to do something so bad and God doesn't prevent us from doing it that we say, "Oh, it's the will of God." And it's not the will of God. And let us not be deceived into believing that if we act outside of God's will, that there will be no consequences for us to suffer. Because there are. Abraham was not commanded to go to Egypt. Abraham was not forbidden to go to Egypt. So the only other reasonable explanation here is that God allowed Abraham to go to Egypt. Now, when we look at the life of Abraham, as soon as he leaves the promised land and goes into Egypt, first of all, we've seen this in that study in Genesis 12. We have to take note here and understand that in God allowing Abraham to go to Egypt, this is not the will of God for Abraham's life, because what does he immediately do? Remember, as soon as Abraham leaves the promised land, he enters into a lie. Remember, because he gets into Egypt, and what does he immediately do? He lies concerning Sarai. And he says, "This is not my wife, this is my sister." Remember this truth. To leave God's promises, to forsake God's promises, to walk away from God's truth is inevitably to enter into a lie. And we find that that's true when Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4, when Paul says to Timothy, he says, "The day will come that they will not endure sound doctrine." What does he say? "They'll heap to themselves teacher having itching ears." He says, "They shall turn away their ears from the truth." And what's the result? "They shall be turned unto fables," unto fables, unto lies, unto fiction. In other words, what's being said. So to turn away from truth If one does not embrace truth and rejects truth rather than embrace it, what else in the world is left for them to embrace? Lies. Right? Lies. If you reject truth, then you're embracing that which is false. Is that not true? So see, Paul tells Timothy there'll be a time when men will reject truth. They'll turn their ears away from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. The reason he says that is because men willfully turn their ears away, but as soon as they turn their ears away, they're turned to fables. Because as soon as you reject truth, you're turned to lies. And is that not exactly what Abraham does? He walks, he leaves God's promise, the promises of God, turns to Egypt, and immediately leads his family into this lie. That this is not my sister, my wife, but this is my sister. And furthermore, how do we know without any doubt that this was not the will of God for Abraham's life? How do we know that? Do you recall how we know this is not the case? Because remember, we find when Abraham leaves, what does Pharaoh do to Abraham? He gives him gifts. He gives him riches. So Abraham, now many of us would again say it in Genesis 12, we go, well, surely God, this was a blessing of God because this was the will of God because Abraham is increased with goods because he did this. No, God never told Abraham to go. And all, in truth, it winds up just costing him greatly. And if you recall with me, remember one of the tensions that split Lot and Abraham up? What was it? The cattle. What did Pharaoh give Abraham? Cattle. So there's a point of contention there between family, brothers, if you will. Remember, it refers to him as brothers, uncle, nephew, but yet he calls him his brother. So here you have brothers of the same family, and the riches that came from Egypt that we would say, oh, God blessed Abraham, they end up being a point of contention with brothers. Furthermore, what do we find out? Another reason we know that it was not God's will for Abraham to go to Egypt. What's the big flashing yellow bright sign that says no? God didn't tell him to go, but what was the result? What resulted from his visit to Egypt? Hagar, what kind of a handmaid was she? An Egyptian handmaid, meaning she came from where? From Egypt. Where did they get her from? When they went to Egypt, no doubt. And Hagar comes in, and Hagar and Abraham have Ishmael, which is of the flesh, and God never refers to Ishmael, recognizes that he is a descendant of Abraham, but he's not of the promise. And remember Genesis 22, take now thy son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest. So God did not acknowledge Ishmael as Abraham's son, knowing he was Abraham's son, but not of his doing, not of his promise, not of faith. So I would say, do you not understand tonight, would you not agree that Abraham, now yes, he loved Ishmael, I understand that, but even in this, God eventually told Abraham to cast Ishmael out. Remember, send him away. Remember that? And what did Abraham do? He grieved. Remember, because he loved Ishmael. My point is this, though he loved Ishmael and he surely had a relationship with Ishmael, and you could say, well, God did bless in giving him Ishmael, and yeah, you can say God blessed in that respect. But even in having Ishmael, it still cost him grief because he had to separate from him. So nothing that took place out of his trip to Egypt resulted in good. It didn't. The cattle ended up being a point of contention, did it not? That goods he'd received that we would call blessings of God really ended up being a problem between brothers, between his nephew Lot, a brother he calls him. And then Hagar comes back. Oh, we've got servants. Oh, that's great. But guess what? Now you have Ishmael, which is not of God's plan and God's purpose. It's your doing. It's your disobedience, your unbelief that's produced this. And now Ishmael causes Abraham grief and that he has to send him away by the command of God. So Egypt was not a prosperous trip for Abraham. But what do we find? God did not command him to go, but neither did God forbid him to go. God allowed him to go. Again, just a word of caution before we move on. We need to be aware of this. Take warning. God will allow us to do things sometimes And we may even prosper in what we do. But you can never say that is proof that that's the will of God. Because it wasn't with Abraham. And what did Abraham ultimately do in Egypt? He failed, didn't he? He failed his family. He failed his wife. In the end, he failed because of unbelief and having Hagar, taking her in, having Ishmael. He failed. The trip to Egypt was a trip of failure. He failed. Everything about Egypt, he failed. And yet we find there are times the Lord allows us to fail. Why does God allow us to fail? Why do you think God does allow us? Because God could stop us, couldn't He? Could God not prevent us from ever failing? Of course He could. Why does He allow us to fail? We must look to Him. We must depend upon Him. We are reminded we must trust and depend wholly upon Him. Through our failures, His sufficiency and His faithfulness are magnified. Now, God's not the author of our failures, just like God did not author Abraham to go to Egypt. But God did not command him to go, and He did not forbid him to go. He allowed him to go. Secondly, let's look at the famine in Isaac's day in Genesis 26, as we've read 1 and 2. There was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. See the connection here? Isn't that interesting that we see the connection being brought to us? And he says, "And Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, Go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of." Now Egypt, as proved in the life of Abraham in the past, and the nation of Israel as we understand it in the future, it was a place of trouble and testing. Egypt, although very tempting, proved to be a place of great problems for God's people. Is that not true? Was it a problem for Abraham? Yes. Would it have been a problem for Isaac? Yes. That's why God tells him not to go. Was it a problem for Israel? Yes. As a nation, remember when they go to Egypt and they end up staying there? We'll look at that in just a moment. Isaac did not go into Egypt, but did go to Gerar, and that's a town of the Philistines, as we see, which was the border of the Canaanites. If you go to Genesis 10 and verse 19, it says, "And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gerar, unto Gaza, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha." So here we find that this town of Gerar is a border of the Canaanites. God allows Isaac to go to the border. And why did God specifically, now look at the grace of God in this. Abraham was not forbidden to go to Egypt. God allows him to go, and it ended up in terrible consequences for Abraham and continuing on even. And so that's a huge problem. Isaac, it doesn't say he's going to Egypt, but he goes to Gerar, and there's a famine. He goes to Gerar, to the land of the Philistines, to Abimelech. And what does God do? What does God tell him? Do not go to Egypt. Now, why would God tell Isaac not to go to Egypt? Well, first of all, it doesn't say this, but by the fact that God told him not to, I think it's pretty clearly stated, without being said, that Isaac was, if not intending to go, was looking that direction. By the way, why wouldn't he? His father went. Right? Why would Isaac not go when Abraham went? It would kind of somewhat be the natural thing for him to do. By the way, isn't it interesting also that while in all three accounts, while Israel or while Canaan suffers from famine, Egypt seems to have plenty. Or they wouldn't be looking that direction. And so what we see is that Isaac, unlike Abraham, does not go to Egypt, but he goes to Gerar. He goes to the border of the Canaanites. God allowed him to go to that extent, but then he prevented him from going any further. He prevented him from going down into Egypt. It says in verse 2 again that the Lord appeared unto him and said, "Go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of." The divine intervention of God prevented Isaac from falling prey to the same failure as that of his father. Again, God did not instruct Abraham to go, and God did not forbid Abraham to go, but Abraham should have never gone. Notice with me, Abraham, one of the faults I see with Abraham concerning going to Egypt when he went in Genesis 12 is that he never even sought the counsel of God. He just went. Why did he go? Remember, we dealt with this. Why did Abraham go to Egypt? Because there was a famine. But why choose Egypt? Proverbs 3, 5, trust in the Lord with all thine heart. And what? Lean not unto thine own understanding. Here you find walking by faith and walking by sight. Walking by faith is trust God. Look to Him. Rest in Him. Depend on Him. Walking by sight is leaning to my own understanding. Abraham thought it was better for his family. I said it to you like this in our study of Genesis 12 some months back. If you recall, I said to you, the problem is this, and how true this is today. Abraham thought he could provide better for his family in Egypt than God could provide for his family in Canaan. Isn't that true today as well? People reason out that they can do better. Oh, if I do this, God's opening this door. God's letting me do this. God's allowed me. I'm praying God let me do this. And walking through that door saying, I can do this better here than God can provide for me here. Unbelief. Walking by sight rather than faith. So what we find here is though God allows Isaac to go to the border of the Canaanites, but prevents him in divine intervention from going into Egypt, which would have been disastrous. There's just no doubt about it. Or God would not have prevented him from going. So what God allowed Abraham to do, go to Egypt, God prevented Isaac from doing. Might we say it like this? God delivered Abraham from out of Egypt while preserving Isaac from Egypt. Let me just make an application here. You know, and thank God for both truths here. Isn't it wonderful when you hear someone speak of how God has saved them out of sin? And I don't mean someone elaborating on their sin, but whenever you know someone who's been just a bondage to sin, obviously their life is just enslaved to sin, and you know that they obviously need the Lord and they're not redeemed, and then God saves them and you hear of the wonderful testimony of God's grace and how God saved me out of this and out of that and how God delivered me out of this and out of that. Isn't that wonderful to hear that? Well, let me tell you what else is wonderful. It's just as wonderful to hear when someone can stand up and say, you know what? God saved me from all that. He preserved me by grace from all of that. I know I was not into all of this, but it's by the grace of God He saved me before He allowed me to get there. And that's similar to what we see with Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, God allows him to go, but God's going to bring him back and God's going to intervene, and He does, doesn't He? But look at the heartache, by the way. Is it not true? God's grace is rich and it's abundant. And thank God His forgiveness is endless, and His mercy is forevermore, and His compassions fail not. And we're thankful for all these things. But oh, isn't it wonderful to have a life that's been preserved from all of that, saved by God's grace, and not carry with you the baggage, the Hagars, the Ishmaels, the heartache, the burden of all the unbelief that could be. Isn't it wonderful whenever God rescues us in preventing us from ever going down that road? Now, we're still sinners, still lost, still condemned to hell, but the grace of God. But yet, God spares us from all that we could have gotten into and could have been. And it's not that we were any better off. It's just, thank God, we don't have to carry all that baggage. Isaac did not have regrets from going to Egypt. Why did he not have regrets? Not because Isaac wouldn't have gone, but because the grace of God prevented him from going. Then we find the famine in Jacob's day. Genesis 46, verse 1. And Israel took his journey, that's Jacob, with all that he had, and came to Beersheba, and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. fear not to go down into Egypt. For I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him. Now, God makes a great nation of Israel while they are in Egypt. But that is not their dwelling place. Where is their dwelling place? What has God promised them? Canaan. He's not promised them Egypt. He promised them Canaan. But now, look at the difference here. Abraham, let's go back. I know this is repetitive, but we need to compare them and understand them. Abraham is never commanded to go to Egypt, but never forbidden to go to Egypt. God allows him to go to Egypt. Isaac is commanded that he not go into Egypt. Jacob is commanded to go into Egypt. Three different men, same circumstance, there's a famine, that's the problem, same God. But notice something with me. He deals with each one differently, even in the same circumstance. Why does he do that? Why does God allow Abraham to go when he shouldn't have gone? Why does he forbid and prevent by his grace Isaac from going when he would have gone? And yet command Jacob to go when he would not have gone. Notice with me, with the command to go into Egypt also came what? What did God also tell Jacob? He told him to go into Egypt, but what else did he tell him? He didn't leave it there. He gave him a promise that he would bring him back out. He says that he would bring Jacob or Israel back out of Egypt. The very command for Jacob to go into Egypt was part of God fulfilling his promise to Abraham. Do you remember that? When we think of the promises of God to Abraham, what do we normally think of? First thing we think of? Canaan, okay, the promised land. What else? What else do we think of when we think of God's promises to Abraham? Canaan, the seed. What else? Anything else? We forget this one. God, to have a son, to have Isaac. But why don't we ever remember this? Go back to Genesis 15, 13, and 14. When God makes this covenant with Abraham, look at what else the Lord told Abraham. And you'll remember this when we get there. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety, thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. What is the Lord speaking of? Their time in Egypt. So God is commanding Jacob to go into Egypt, but by doing so, it is all a part of fulfilling his promise that he made to Abraham. Because God has already foretold that your seed will go, I'll make a nation out of them, they're gonna live in a land that is not theirs, they're gonna be afflicted for 400 years. But he also said, I will bring them out. I will bring them out. Now, what is he telling Jacob in the verses we read a moment ago? Look at verse 3. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Chapter 46 of Genesis. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. There's some great truths here I want to get into in just a moment, but let me not get there just yet. With the command to go into Egypt also came the promise of God to bring Jacob or to bring Israel back out of Egypt. The Lord's command for Jacob to go down to Egypt was a command that would result in two things. First of all, it resulted in the condemnation of Egypt. Remember what happened in Egypt in the end? They were condemned. Why were they condemned? They were condemned because of God delivering Israel out of Egypt. Through that, Israel is condemned. Egypt is condemned. But then we also find it resulted in the blessing of Israel. In Romans 9:17, the scripture says, for the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for the same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. God. Now, Paul here is quoting back in Exodus where the Lord is saying that He raised Pharaoh to power for the very purpose that He might manifest His name and make His name known among the nations. How did that happen? Do you remember as Joshua, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, whenever Joshua led the children of Israel into over Jordan and back into Canaan, just as God had promised, do you remember they came across this great walled city? What was the name of that city? Jericho. Who did they meet in Jericho? Rahab. Do you remember what Rahab said? Do you, any of you remember what Rahab said in her discourse with the spies? Rahab said, We have heard of your God and what He did in Egypt. What did God do through Pharaoh? He made His name known and His power known. Jericho knew about Egypt and what God had done in Egypt. And the result, the end result of Israel being in Egypt was this. Egypt came under condemnation and was virtually destroyed, and Israel was blessed. Because what did they do? No, I won't let your people go. No, I will not let God's people out. God, we will not let God's people go. And here come the plagues. No, I will not let them go. Okay, I'll let them go with compromise. Remember, I'll let them go and you can take this and that, but not this. No, let them go. No, I will not let them go. In the end, they paid them to leave. They willingly gave of their substance that Israel would just be gone. Remember that? So Israel is blessed. Egypt is condemned. All this is fulfilling God's promise to Abraham. Let me say it to you like this, in truth. Yes, God preserved Israel by them going into Goshen and living there. Remember, God preserved them. And then they became afflicted in Egypt, just as God had promised. But here's what we need to understand. The command of God for Jacob to go into Egypt while He allowed Abraham, though He did not command him and did not forbid him, though He prevented Isaac when he would have gone, He kept him from going, and now He commands Jacob to go. But let us be mindful of this. Hear very closely. The command for Jacob to go into Egypt was much, bigger part, or there was a bigger picture here than that of just Jacob alone. It was a promise that had been made to Abraham and Israel, or Jacob as a nation. So see, God was working in this and told him to go. Now, what were we to learn from this, though? Well, the same Lord, using the same means, that being a famine, dealt in three different ways with three different men. But notice something. In every single case, it all resulted in the fulfillment of God's purpose and plan. God allowing Abraham to go and failing as He did, what did that do? That just taught Abraham to trust the Lord, didn't it? I mean, that was part of one of the pieces of the puzzle that taught Abraham to trust God. It was. His failures taught, he learned something from them. What about Isaac? Why did God preventing Isaac from going? Well, God was fulfilling His promise in the life of Isaac. Therefore, He did not want him to go. By the way, do you remember what Abraham said to the servant about Isaac? Do not let him go back. Do not let him go back to my home. Well, now God's saying, not only are you not going to go back to your homeland, your father's homeland, but you're not going back to Egypt or going to Egypt either. God prevents him from going. Now He tells Jacob, go. Do not fear to go, but go. But know this, Jacob. Now look at what the Lord tells Jacob here. I will go with you, and I will bring you back again. Now, Jacob lived in Goshen in Egypt, and for 400 years, they were in bondage to the Egyptians, Israel was. But Israel did come out in the Exodus. God fulfilled His purpose, His promise, and His plan. I believe it's important to take note also that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, look, do not miss this. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all three had to deal with Egypt during their life. Neither one of the three ever got a reprieve from having to be confronted or contend with Egypt. You know, Egypt is all around us, is it not? and the allurements of Egypt are all around us. And sometimes, I'll be honest with you, things seem much easier in Egypt. They really do. Just as it was with the children of Israel, so with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the children of Israel, so it is with us. As a matter of fact, is it not true that even after God delivered them in the Exodus out of the bondage, out of the oppression, from all of the death and beatings and sufferings and slavery that they were in to the Egyptians, what did they say in the wilderness? What did the people say when it became a little tough in the wilderness? What did they begin to say? Take us back to Egypt. We'd rather die under their slavery than we would out here in the wilderness. Remember them saying that? Is that not true of us as well? We have that tendency. This flesh wants it easy. Rather than trusting God. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all had to contend with Egypt in their lifetime. None of them were exempt from being faced with the temptations of Egypt. Now, God kept Isaac from going, but I'm telling you, the verse here makes it pretty clear to me, Isaac pretty much had intentions on going to Egypt, just as his father had done, but God prevented him. But isn't this the overall message of this text? When we consider the famine that Isaac went through, looking back in the past to the famine that Abraham went through, looking forward in the future to the famine that Jacob would go through, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there is one consistent in all of it. God deals differently with them. They all do something different, right? Abraham goes of his own will. Isaac is prevented from going. Jacob goes by the command of God. So all three do something different. Though Abraham and Jacob both go, it's not under the same circumstances. The famine, but not by Abraham went of his own will, not by God's will. So it's different in that respect. But what one thing remains constant in it all? It's very simple. God's faithfulness to His purpose and plan. Hear me. If you can't get anything else, let's just make this application. Because these things are here for our examples, right? That's what Scripture says. I'm not saying this is a type. I'm saying they are here for our example. And here's the example I see in this. Whether God has allowed you to go into Egypt outside of His will and then faithfully has brought you back out, whether God has prevented you from going into Egypt, as you would, your flesh would desire to do by His grace, or whether God has commanded you to go into Egypt, not become part of it, but enter into it, promising He would be with you and pull you back out of it, God is faithful to His purpose and plan no matter what situation it may be. He remains faithful. John 17:15-16. You know what Jesus prayed? He said, I pray not to the Father that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Whether the Lord pulled you out of the world, preserved you from a life in the world, or as a believer, under His command, commanded us to go into the world, in it, but not of it, God never lacks in demonstrating His faithfulness, regardless. God is faithful. Is He not? And we see that in every one of these examples. Abraham did what he shouldn't have done, but God allowed him to. And what does God prove? What's He proven that? That He's faithful. You can trust Me, Abraham. And forgiveness, doesn't He? Isaac is commanded by God not to go. And he says, but stay where I tell you to, Isaac. And what does Isaac do? He obeys God. And what does God prove in that? He's faithful. You can trust Him. Jacob goes where it seems like God would never want him to go because his grandfather went outside of God's will. His father was commanded not to go. And now God tells him to go, which seems really strange, doesn't it? But Jacob obeys, submits to the purpose and plan of will of God, and what does God prove? He's faithful. Exactly like He said. God proves in every one of these situations that He is faithful and that He can be trusted. He will fulfill His plan and His purpose to His own glory. And it's our responsibility, behooves us, does it not, to simply submit to His purpose, to His plan, to His will, to His Word, as the Spirit would guide us and lead us in His truth. Jesus said, "Ye are in the world, but not of it." We're not of the world. God has put us in the world. And do you know what? You know what God placing us in the world does? Remember I told you with Jacob? Again, just as an example here, similar, somewhat of a parallel. God puts Jacob in Egypt. And in the end, what does it do? It's to the condemnation of Egypt. It stands against the judgment of Egypt and to the blessing of Israel. Does it not? And might I say to you, we are in the world and not of the world, but the presence of the light and the salt in the midst of darkness and evil will stand as a testimony against the world as God would judge it in condemnation, but yet a blessing to those who are in Christ in the end. We deal with the same problems, don't we? Sin. They had to deal with famine. We have to deal with sin, just as they had to deal with sin as well. And even though God deals separately and differently and individually with each one, isn't it great to know that even if we and when we, I shouldn't say if we, but even when we wander outside of the will of God and the purpose and plan of God, God's still faithful. It's only by the faithfulness of God, by His grace, He prevents us from going there all the time, isn't it? Isn't it? And when God commands us to go into the world, not of it, but go into it, as He has in the church, isn't it wonderful to know we can count and depend upon a faithful God who can keep us from the evil, as Christ prayed in John 17? The message is very simple tonight. And I say this over and over throughout the book of Genesis, but isn't it wonderful that this truth is so established in the first book of the Bible that we can see it consistently throughout the remainder of the rest? And it's simply this: God is faithful. And let me add to that, because it helps us to appreciate God's faithfulness a little more when we preface it with this: men are failures, and yet God is faithful.